From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Cuba's Fidel Castro has announced he's resigning almost half a century after La Revolucion. President Dwight D. Eisenhower held office when the cigar-smoking leader transformed the nation into a communist country.
Revolución es sentido del momento histórico. Es cambiar todo lo que debe ser cambiado. Es igualdad y libertad plena. Es ser tratado y tratar a los demás como seres humanos.
He's commanded the respect of people who thought that his revolution was populist and it transformed Cuba's post-colonial racism. Joining me now is Frances Robles. She's a correspondent with the Miami Herald. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
So Fidel Castro has been ill and his brother has been running the country since 2006. Why is he stepping down now?
On Sunday, Cuba's National Assembly will meet to choose members of the Council of State and the President of the Council of State. The President of the Council of State is essentially the President of Cuba. So this is the perfect time for Fidel Castro to finally acknowledge, look, I'm not fit for this post.
So how is this playing out in Miami?
It's pretty calm. About a year and a half ago, when Fidel first got sick, there was thousands of people dancing in the streets in absolute glee. They suffered a black eye for that because, well, he didn't die for one, and the government continued in office. So now people are taking a pretty measured wait-and-see attitude.
How do you think this is playing among dissidents in Cuba right now?
They're cautious. A lot of people use the expression, well, you know, this is the same dog with a different collar. However, others are really hoping that this is going to be a big moment for Cuba. Nobody's accusing Raul Castro of being a Democrat who's going to call for free elections tomorrow, but they do think that he's somebody that could start making changes that are going to improve people's lives.
So President Bush responded to the news yesterday while he was traveling in Rwanda. He said Castro's resignation meant a period of transition for Cuba. What does it mean for the U.S.? What is the U.S. expected to do? There's been a crackdown, for example, during the Bush administration over remittances, over travel. Is there going to be an easing of those, do you think?
Well, right now there can't be. There's still the Helms-Burton Law, which makes it illegal to trade or deal with Cuba as long as there are hundreds of political prisoners and no democratic elections. So they can choose Raul, they can choose somebody else, but until a certain set of conditions are met, that's not going to change any relations with Washington.
How important is it that Castro still heads the ruling Communist Party? Is that symbolic or is that going to have an effect on policy?
Well, that's going to be a really important thing to wait and see. What does that mean? Does that mean that he's going to have an office with a staff and still be making orders? That's really unclear. That it was very interesting to see that when he laid out his resignation or what jobs he was stepping down from, that he did not mention a very powerful position. It sort of suggests that he's going to be lurking in the shadows, perhaps getting in the way.
I visited Cuba many years ago, and as you well know, it's a very complicated situation. I got the sense that people who were on the island now feared that wealthy expats would come back to the country, buy up everything, since wages are so low and the country's struggling. Is that conversation bubbling up at all?
People are really afraid of capitalism in Cuba. I've never been able to figure out whether that's been because of 49 years of propaganda by the communist government or just real fear, or a little bit of both, probably. People are really afraid. People are afraid that they're going to lose their homes, that they're going to lose, well, they don't really have any businesses, but the little that they'll have, they don't want to see people from the United States come take it.
Is race a factor in all of this? Because many of the Cuban expats, certainly not all, are more fair-skinned and have more Spanish heritage. Many of the people in Cuba are darker-skinned and have more African heritage. How does race play into all this?
Well, it's really interesting. I think Cuba likes to spread the myth that they've ended racism in Cuba. And that's simply not the case. One of the things that a lot of people argue is that even the things that are going on in Cuba, whatever benefits there have been, didn't necessarily reach a lot of the black people. The best tourism jobs, you will rarely see a black person in the tourism industry. You also rarely see a black person getting remittances from the relatives in Miami because the relatives in Miami, as you pointed out, are mostly white. I don't sense that black Cubans resent white Miamians. I think they resent the conditions that they live in and the poverty that they're suffering.
Finally, what do you see ahead, just briefly, in terms of how this is going to unfold from the Cuban-U.S. relations side?
There's going to be a lot more pressure to lift the embargo. Already yesterday, a lot of people were saying that this shows that Cuba policy failed and that it's time to change it.
All right. Well, Francis, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Francis Robles reports on Cuba for the Miami Herald, and she joined me from the WLRN's news studios at the Miami Herald.
I am here to report that my bet has paid off and my faith in the American people has been vindicated, because all across the country, people are standing up and saying it is time to turn the page. It is time to write a new chapter in American history. We want to move forward into a better tomorrow.
Winds in Wisconsin and Washington give John McCain a virtual lock on the Republican nomination. For the latest election news, we have NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So Barack Obama seems to be on a roll. Is it enough to put him in a safe front-runner position?
There's no such thing as a safe front-runner position until you actually have enough delegates to be nominated. And, of course, he's not nearly to that threshold yet. He would have to be over 2,000 delegates to get there, and he's just past the 1,300 delegate mark. But in terms of momentum, in terms of building sense of inevitability, this was a brand new Barack Obama that we saw last night celebrating in Houston when he said his campaign had achieved liftoff and the crowd went crazy. We've seen a lot of crowds go crazy, and we've seen Barack look happy after previous events in this long streak of 10 that you mentioned, but nothing quite like this. This was a new sense of confidence and a new showing of confidence on his part.
How did white women support or not support Hillary Clinton?
White women still supported Hillary Clinton, but by a very narrow margin. Taking women of all races, Barack Obama was ahead or equal among women. And we've seen that before, but only in states where there was a substantial population of black women and Latino women. This is a different situation. In Wisconsin, virtually 90% of the participants on the Democratic side were white. And as a result, for him to basically tie among women, almost get to an even point among white women, is kind of a first for the Barack Obama campaign. That, of course, is the bastion of Hillary Clinton's support.
There's also a question about whether blue-collar workers, people who, for example, might be current or former factory workers, are going to support Barack Obama, who's had a little bit more of the urban middle-class lock on the vote. Ohio and Texas are coming up. How do you think that Barack Obama's chances and Hillary Clinton's chances are with people who were real working folks?
This is the clear question going into those two states. And the chill for the Clinton campaign this morning was to look at the numbers and see how many people in union households had voted for Barack Obama. People who said that the economy was the number one issue voted for Barack Obama. People in union households went about 50-50. Very bad news for Hillary Clinton, because she's counting on not just doing well, but doing quite well in that particular sector, union households.
Let's turn to John McCain. Here's a clip from his victory speech last night.
Or will we heed appeals for change that ignore the lessons of history and lack confidence in the intelligence and ideals of free people? I will fight every moment of every day in this campaign to make sure Americans are not deceived by an eloquent but empty call for change.
So this is another rhetoric dig seems to be targeted at Barack Obama, with Hillary Clinton and John McCain going for the whole rhetoric issue. Is it going to start making a dent?
We shall see. It did not seem to help her too much in Wisconsin. Two-thirds of those in the exit polls said that they thought she had run the more negative campaign in Wisconsin, and A good deal of that was built around an assault on his words or on his reputation as a person whose rhetorical skills were at the heart of his appeal to voters. Already last night, we saw Barack Obama talking about issues, talking about substance, a little bit more programmatic talk in his lengthy speech there in Houston, Texas. I think we'll probably hear a little more of that from him. But both, as you say, McCain and Clinton are zeroing in on this particular perception, clearly showing up in polls that they're looking at, that Barack Obama really hasn't said that much about what he would do as president, what exactly his analysis of world problems and domestic problems would be, and what programs would come from that analysis, and that he has been mostly about lifting people up. We'll see how that plays out in the next 2 weeks.
When it comes to Mike Huckabee, how big of a factor is he still, or is he just kind of running the marathon, not even to try to, not just to win, but even to make it to the finish line, or is he going to stay in this until it's all over?
There are a certain number of people in any big marathon field who are doing it to do it, who are doing it to show they can finish, to prove something to themselves and to others. I don't think Mike Huckabee necessarily goes all the way to St. Paul in Minneapolis in September trying to prove that he is still challenging John McCain. I think he will drop out well before that. I suspect he'll drop out after the March 4th events in Texas and Ohio, because at that point John McCain will numerically have enough delegates to be the nominee. But he's been staying in it, both to make a point about the strength of a certain faction within the Republican ranks, also to expand his own recognizability. I suspect we'll be seeing a lot more of Mike Huckabee on television in the months and years ahead, maybe even to be a candidate for president again in 2012.
All right, Ron. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor, and he spoke with us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Now's the time when politics gets rough. Senator McCain is ready to fight the Democrats, and it's still rough and tumble for Senators Clinton and Obama. There's a three-way fight over plagiarism, waterboarding, and whether style is winning over substance. Today we've got Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a former commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And Ron Christie is the vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also a former Deputy Assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. Hi, folks.
Hello there, Farai.
So Obama has won his 10th straight primary.
Mm-hmm.
Mary, do you think that Clinton can still make it happen?
Well, in fact, he won primaries and caucuses. He didn't win. They weren't all primaries. Not that it makes that much of a difference, but they weren't. I mean, I guess it does make a difference. I think that for Clinton, she said that if she didn't make it to her supporters, that if she didn't make it in Ohio and Texas, that would be the definitive point. And I think that's true. I think she can go on to Ohio and Texas. And if she doesn't win there, then I think it's over. In fact, the delegate race remains close enough. It's not like Huckabee and McCain, where there's a big gap. I mean, they both got a large number of supporters and delegates, and I think she can go on to there. But the most frightening thing for Hillary Clinton is that coming into the race as a white woman, I am sure she expected to have a reliable base with white women. And white women have not been a reliable base. They're not like the black vote that votes, you know, we presumptively will vote for a black candidate. Even white
so
men.
So people have been saying
men.
That's, let me just jump in, because people have been saying, oh, no, I'm not voting for the black man because he's a black man. You're saying people are voting for the black man because he's a black man.
Yes, the black people are voting for the black man because he's a black man, and the white people are voting for him because he's a stylish, likable black man, and they believe that it's time to make a racial change in this country. But white women don't have that same kind of consciousness, my students tell me, my white women students. They don't think of themselves as a block of white women. They think of they haven't learned that. They don't think about that. They don't have any political consciousness as white women. They don't really particularly care whether a woman wins. And I think that that was a presumption that the Clinton campaign made, and they were wrong. And now that's one of the reasons why they're in trouble.
Now, Ron, I was watching MSNBC last night, and white men came up, and one analyst made a assertion that white men just basically hate Hillary Clinton. That's one person's assertion. What do you think of it?
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm never one to make a broad generalization like that. I do believe, picking up on Mary's point, that Senator Clinton went into this election thinking that she had a particular demographic of people that were locked up for her. She had the women vote. She thought that she would also be able to count on the Hispanic vote and that she would be able to utilize the support of people who were making less than $50,000 who had a very limited form of education. What we've seen with Senator Obama in the last 10 contests, if you will, is that the demographic blocks that the senator anticipated that would go to her column are going to Senator Obama. And again, I think she has made a gross miscalculation. Mary and I were talking about this off the air. There's a likability factor for Rye that I think people don't want to look at position papers. They don't want to go to the website and read all your stuff. They want to be inspired. They want to be uplifted. They want a positive message of this is why I'm voting for somebody because they make me feel good. And I think Senator Obama is cleaning her clock because people like him and they feel inspired and they don't really seem to like her.
And if you go all the way back, Farah, to the election of Franklin Roosevelt in his first term, and you look at all the elections since, likability always trumps substance and talking about issues and all the rest of that. People just, you know, maybe most of them feel that at the margins it doesn't really matter that much, but doggone it, at least they can feel good about who they picked and hope that it'll be a pleasant 4 years that they can be around and, you know, watch them and listen to them.
Well, on that note, Senator Clinton has been saying that Barack Obama is all flash and no public policy. From what you're saying, that might not be such a good message. And here's how Obama responded in a speech last weekend.
Don't tell me words don't matter. I have a dream, just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, just words. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, just words, just speeches.
The Clinton campaign pulled out a little history, a speech by Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick from 2006. Here's what Patrick said.
Just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Ask not what your country can do.
Now, you get the idea. For his part, Governor Patrick said he gave those lines over to Obama, sort of like a Christmas present, and he didn't want to be credited for them. Mary, you're laughing. What do you think?
At Penn, where I teach students who do that, we call it plagiarism. And it doesn't matter that your frat boy buddy comes in with you to say, well, I don't really care if he took my paper where I put together all those nice things. He's my friend, and we sit for hours talking about that kind of stuff. But you know what? It was plagiarism, but I don't think anybody cares. I don't think they care for the same reason that they don't care. And, you know, Pat Schroeder, when she was in the Congress, called Ronald Reagan the Teflon president. She stood up there with a frying pan and say that no matter what you throw at him, it doesn't stick. He keeps on smiling. And I think Obama's like that. The people who are for him are for him. They have a love affair with him. They're for him. And they don't really care whether you show that he plagiarized. I think Obama could stand in Times Square and pick up the flag and spit on it. And the people who are with him would say, well, that's probably some ritual that he learned down in, you know, wherever he was living, and let's go investigate that. Or it's something that the Clinton people made up or something. I just think that throwing things at him and pointing out things that he's done isn't going to do anybody any good.
Wow, that's a strong statement. Ron, do you think that he's got that much leeway?
I do. I mean, and I, of course, being the ever patriotic one, would never want to say anything about our flag. And I'm pointing at Mary and laughing at her. No, but seriously, I think the Clintons have a serious point here, as does Mary. He can say anything and get away with it and not be held to the same standards of accountability because, again, people want to be inspired and they don't seem to want to look at the substance. I want to look at the substance. Senator Obama talks about making sure that the promises to Medicare and Social Security are kept. Well, if you do that, we have a crushing system that's going to come right now that is going to pass an enormous burden onto the younger people. No one talks about that. Senator Obama talks about rolling back the corporate tax cuts and rolling back the Bush tax cuts. Well, we have the second highest corporate tax rate in the world in the United States, and that does stifle some creativity and innovation. No one talks about that. He's getting a free pass. Perhaps once Senator McCain if, in fact, Senator McCain, the likely presumptive nominee for the Republican nomination, and Senator Obama square off on these issues, it'll come up. But whoever the Republican is who squares off against Obama, if, in fact, he's the Democratic nominee, they're going to have to try to beat him on substance because style, Obama will clean the clock of anyone who goes up against him.
And I'll bet that the substance guy will lose to the style guy.
Yep.
Every time.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's move on to, I guess, the other guy, the guy across the aisle, Senator McCain. I don't know what his nickname is yet, but he's challenged the administration in the past strongly and publicly on interrogations and the issue of torture, but he just voted in the Senate against a ban on waterboarding. So what does that say, Ron, I'll go to you first, about how he's positioning himself? Is he entrenching himself ever deeper with administration policies that pertain to war and terrorism in an effort to distinguish himself from the Democrats?
I think what Senator McCain is trying to do right now is to appeal to the conservative base of the Republican Party, who are a little bit skeptical, perhaps is the best way of putting it, of his conservative credentials. Senator McCain voted against the Bush tax cuts back in 2001 and 2003, one of two Republicans. The other was Lincoln Chafee, who since defeated. Now, McCain says that he's wrapping himself up in the Bush tax cuts. Senator McCain has been a critic of the administration with waterboarding and the war on terrorism policy. Now, Senator McCain is embracing the administration's positions on the war on terrorism. I think it's a smart play if you're appealing for a primary. Senator McCain needs to realize right now he's got the primary locked up. He needs to appeal to the general constituency, those independents, those moderates, those Democrats who might vote for him. Continuing to wrap himself up in the conservative banner right now, I believe, is a strategy that's fraught with peril going up against the Democrats.
Because most Americans right now are saying we need to get out of Iraq? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. I think a majority of the country right now is conservative on social issues. I think the country is very much divided on the war on terrorism. McCain cannot be perceived as being the third term of the Bush administration as far as McCain's strategy is concerned because people have indicated that they're looking for a change. Now, I'm a strong proponent of the president, his policies and his positions, but if Senator McCain wants to have a chance to win, he's got to appeal to those moderates and independents who aren't trending towards the president.
But he's also got to appeal to you, people like you, Ron.
He does.
So he's got a problem. He's got to appeal to the base in his party, and as he goes into the general election, what he wants to do is have a consolidated base first. You must do that first.
That's right.
And then he wants to let the independents who like him because he's a maverick point to things he's done like immigration reform and other kinds of things. And I think on this waterboarding thing, he can argue that he knew this was going nowhere because the president's going to veto it and the Democrats don't have 60 votes.
Right.
So nothing is going to happen. So that he thought that since it was a silly sort of charade from his point of view, I can see him explaining that, he thought he would just give them a little no and tell them that that, you know, silly little tactic wasn't going to get them anywhere, but that that doesn't mean that he condones waterboarding.
That's right.
I think he'll try to have that one both ways.
All right. I want to take a quick dip into state, well, local politics. Kwame Kilpatrick, mayor of Detroit, is facing a recall. There's a whole scandal over a whistleblower settlement that cost over $8 million, misuses of city funds, and sex, which always makes things interesting. Do you think, Mary, that this is going to torpedo him? And also, what does it do for the image of black legislators?
Well, it's bad for the image, since we all have to be, since he's black, we all have to be the black legislator. But I think that the only thing that can really get him in trouble is the part about the illegality. If, in fact, he did, in this whistleblower suit, say that he didn't have an affair that he was having, and if they can prove that and the prosecutor can, that'll get him into real trouble. The recall can get him into trouble if it succeeds, and I see that the effort is going forward. But I think that things like getting his wife a car or things like that, I don't think. And I think that his personal life, if he wants to have an affair, fine. That, I mean, maybe it was sort of sleazy, but if that's what he wants to do and if he's stupid enough to write emails all over the place, that's fine. But where he will be kicked out will be based on illegality. You know, what did he do that was illegal in that settlement, the whistleblower's case, and what has he done to violate the rules there? But he's a huge embarrassment, and in a way it would be much better if he would just simply resign.
Ron, briefly, do you think that he's going to affect other people? It's just this image that, you know, a lot of urban areas have poor leadership.
Look, I've been involved in politics for 17 years of my life. Mary's been involved in politics
forever.
Forever. The reality of it is that you have to, in my opinion, do it cleaner, smarter, and straighter than other folks because you're being judged by a different standard. Once you go under oath and you make a statement under oath that you did not do certain things and then it comes out that you have done certain things, it is a bad thing for that individual, as an individual mayor in this case, but also the way that people perceive African-American politicians. It's a disgrace. It's a disappointment. He ought to go. He needs to resign.
All right. Ron, Mary, thanks.
Thank you, Farai.
Ron Christie is the vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, also a former deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. And Dr. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and a former commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. They both joined us from our DC studios. We report and you have your say. We're talking about our blog, News and Views. The big news on the blog this week is superdelegates and a new site that lets you know who and where they are. Our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, has the inside track. Hey.
Hey, Farai.
So what's the dealy?
Well, it's called superdelegates.org, and for folks who are confused about who these people are or what they do, this nonpartisan site offers a full list of all the Democratic superdelegates, and it's updated to reflect which candidate these superdelegates are endorsing. Now, that information is then cross-indexed with a Google map, so you can see where each of these people are located across the U.S. And then if you click their name, you get in-depth biographical data about each of them. So it's a pretty cool resource.
So is someone going to chip them and follow them around if they go grocery shopping?
Yeah, that's what's next, right?
So there were a couple of feuds on the blog this week. Break them down for us.
Well, I'll start with the more amusing one, Aretha Franklin versus Beyoncé and Beyoncé's dad. So flashback to last week's Grammys, Beyoncé introduced her duet partner Tina Turner as the queen. Aretha Franklin, the reigning queen of soul, was none too pleased and released a statement saying it was a cheap shot for controversy. Beyoncé's dad slash manager responded saying Franklin's statement was ridiculous. Now, most people on our blog seem to agree. C. Cody wrote, "Riri should have exercised her right to remain queen by remaining silent." And Willis Page had his own beef with Miss Franklin. He wrote, "I've had tickets to see Aretha Franklin three times, and three times she has canceled in different cities. How about being mad at the title of Queen of No-Shows?" And then the other big feud this week was between Tavis Smiley and Michelle Obama. Journalist Tavis Smiley invited Barack Obama to speak at his annual State of the Black Union. Obama declined, saying he had to campaign, but he offered to send his wife Michelle in his place. Tavis Smiley essentially said no thanks. So that post has been the most popular post on our blog all month, and response has been overwhelming in the Obama's favor. Robert E.C. wrote, "Clearly Tavis Smiley sees the State of the Black Union as an event significant as any other political forum this year, but his own ambitions have clouded his judgment." Larry English offered this lofty analogy. He wrote, "This is the equivalent of asking Martin Luther King to leave Birmingham to go on a talk show and then dissing Coretta Scott King because Martin was too busy to leave." And Alan Bell wrote, "It's been said before, but I'll say it again. Obama is running for president of the United States, not president of Black America. He should do whatever is necessary to take the Oval Office, even if it ticks off Tavis Smiley."
All right, Jeff. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Our bloggers are asking, did Barack Obama steal a speech from Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick? Plus, where were you when Michael Jackson unleashed his record-breaking album Thriller 25 years ago? This week, we've got Valencia Rohner with us. She runs the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman. Education analyst Casey Lartig, his blog is The Casey Lartig Show, and writer and social activist Yubachi Boswell of the blog BlackPerspective.net. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
So we talked a little bit about this earlier in the show, but we want your take. Barack Obama gave the speech this weekend in Wisconsin, counterattacking Hillary Clinton, who says he's all words and no substance. And It included the phrase, don't tell me words don't matter, I have a dream, just words. That's Obama. He may have been quoting Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. So Yabachi Deval came out early to support Barack Obama. Patrick is black. He's the governor of Massachusetts. And, you know, he says it's all good, but is that enough to make it okay?
Well, I don't see where the real problem was. The whole phraseology, the whole part that was quoted was popular or classic American rhetoric. It wasn't even Deval Patrick's words anyway. It was JFK and Roosevelt, and this is classic American rhetoric. And these things are quoted regularly. When Kennedy quoted Roosevelt, "You have nothing to fear but fear itself," he didn't stop in the middle of the speech to say Roosevelt said it, but that's the way rhetoric goes. You don't have to stop at every moment to make citations. A speech wouldn't flow very well if you did that all the time.
On Monday, Patrick appeared on Good Morning America, and this is what he said.
And nobody's great policies, by the way, end up on the sides of any of the monuments or buildings in Washington. It is those words, that ability to inspire. And I think that is a tremendous power of Barack Obama, and I'm neither surprised nor troubled that he used the words that I asked him to use of my own.
Valencia, is this a case where you have a candidate who's obviously huddling with some of the best minds in the country, and this is just what happens when you're sitting around in a war room situation exchanging ideas with people who support you?
Oh, absolutely. Deval and Barack have made it clear that they're good friends. They say they share the same campaign manager in David Axelrod. I mean, you know, they're boys, essentially. And he's like, listen, you can use my line. This was not a dissertation. This is not a PhD thesis. This was a couple of lines within a speech. It's not like he used Deval Patrick's speech verbatim, word for word. So I just think it was just merely a desperation move on Clinton's part because they can't come up with anything else to get Barack on it at this point.
Casey, one blogger compared the incident to Jason Blair, the New York Times reporter who said that he'd fabricated stories after being basically hunted down in his news organization. Blair was a total disgrace. What about Obama?
The comparison makes no sense at all. Blair lied. Blair made up stories. Blair talked about being places that he had never been. It's more like Bill Clinton saying he has seen black churches burn more so than anything that Obama just said. Now, I think this whole thing is overblown and it's even pathetic. I think that as one of the other guests said that, you know, that the Clintons are just so desperate for anything. And you look at the kinds of things that gone after him about, you know, what he said back in kindergarten, this thing that he's stealing lines from a buddy of his. You know, and they released the secrets that he wrote in this book. I mean, it's just that they're so desperate. Now, I think there may have been some actual political strategy here as far as maybe, you know, they want to block an endorsement from Joe Biden in addition to also trying to undercut Obama for what he's known for. But, you know, I'm just surprised that Clinton's, for example, didn't release, you know, Chappaquiddick information on Ted Kennedy when he announced that he was for Obama. So this is the way that Clintons operate. And I think this is part of Obama's appeal, that he's saying, look, let's drop the old style smear politics that people are about. And the Clintons are showing up and they're offering even more of what it is that's turning people off. So actually, I think this ends up playing into Obama's hands more than anything else.
Valencia, there's another controversy. While Barack Obama has been battling this issue, Michelle Obama's made her own headlines. And she spoke during a rally and said, quote, hope is making a comeback. And let me tell you, for the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country, not just because Barack is doing well, but I think people are hungry for change. A lot of folks jumped on her and said, what do you mean you weren't proud of your country? Well, you know, what kind of unpatriotic blankety blank are you? What do you think of this?
Well, I guess I'm in good company because a lot of people jumped on me, too, on my blog. I wrote about her statements. I said that I can understand as an African-American woman growing up in this country. She was born in 1963 in the Midwest. As a black woman, you experience and you witness a lot of injustice and a lot of unfairness in spite of your success. And I think this is what she referenced. I wrote about that on my blog as well as wrote about Cindy McCain's response to it. You know, Cindy McCain, you know, with all due respect, she volunteers for a living. I mean, so she, you know, and she has a master's, you know, in something. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it does not equate to a Michelle Obama. So my point, and as a result, I got like 300 hits in about 10 minutes from wow. some very angry, I presume, white folks who just were calling me and her all kinds of names to the point I had to stop comments. So I think it just, again, it's another sign of desperation of people who are not happy with Barack's campaign. And I, too, am very proud of this country. As I said, after Iowa, I wrote, after the Iowa caucus, I wrote, I'm very pleased because I'm seeing something that I did not think was possible. And I'm very proud to be proud of this country as a result.
Yabachi, is this, you know, this whole election in some ways has become more racialized week by week. Is this one of those things where a black person can say this and other black folks, whether they agree or disagree, may say, oh, OK, I understand where she's coming from. But people from other backgrounds may or may not get it.
To some degree, I think people who come from what she's coming from understood what she was trying to get across. And I think what people have to do when they're speaking is realize that everyone else is not in your head and they're not exactly coming from your experience. So you have to elaborate what your frame of reference is when you say something.
Did she mess up? Did she mess up for the campaign team?
She made a slight mistake rhetorically in not expanding on what she was trying to say. I understand where she was coming from. What she was saying was that she was proud in a particular way that she had not had the opportunity to be proud of this country in before. I don't think she was trying to say that she was never proud of America in any way. She was speaking in particular regards to the context she was speaking about. But when you don't elaborate on that, sometimes people don't understand where you're coming from. But if this is the best that they have against the campaign, there's not really much that they have against the campaign. This is the best type of stuff they can come up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Casey. A couple of things. One, I can understand. It's like an Olympic athlete who says, you know, I feel like I'm representing my country, and it's more so than any previous case, and even though I've been a citizen and been happy with all that, that now it's like they're representing the country, they're representing bigger things than before. So maybe, you know, that could be another angle. But I think one danger from this is that Barack Obama has been saying it's not about race. You know, race is not an issue. But now we have people explaining, say, well, but wait, it is about race. And I think that's the kind of thing that can turn voters off, including the ones who've been chanting, it's not about race. And I think she might have also gotten reminded that people are going to be diagramming her sentences like she's back in grammar class and analyzing every single word that she utters, that now everything as far as that she says and does is on the record. So she'll probably have to be a little more careful.
Well, in case you're just tuning in, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're doing our bloggers roundtable with Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Valencia Rohner, she runs the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman, and writer and social activist Yabachi Boswell of BlackPerspective.net. Before we jump back into the substance, Valencia, Diary of a Content Black Woman, you have Diary of an Angry Black Woman. You have a lot of blogs that are referencing that. Why are you content?
Well, first of all, the blog was the same URL, but it was called Why Black Men Are Angry. I made the conscious decision to change the name to Diary of a Content Black Woman because when I started the blog, I was very angry about a whole bunch of stuff, but I did not want to be angry anymore. So it was a kind of a way, and one of the ways, reasons I was angry, because for so long we've had angry white man radio, if you will, and I just felt like there was a limited number of voices. Well, it kind of seemed like after the whole IMUS debacle, it just kind of put light on the limitation of black voices. And then over the last year, because we're coming up on the year anniversary of that situation, it seems like there's been more of forums available for blacks to share their voices. I don't have a problem with angry white men expressing their views, but I think there needed to be an opportunity, and I wanted to lend my voice.
Need to be more angry black people? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I think there needs to be more of a balance of perspective. And I think as a result of all the disparities that exist and the apparent lack of opportunity that seemed to be for African Americans to give their perspective on certain issues and things that impacted the country's views of African Americans and our take on things. I think that's why blogging is so wonderful and shows like yourself, so we can have an opportunity to express our voice. So I'm not angry anymore. I'm far more content.
That's good to know. And Yabachi and Casey, there's been a lot of movement around the black blogosphere and this emerging group of people. And blogs right now are the talk of the political season. They really, you know, started getting entrenched last election, presidential election. But now blogs are so important, and you're seeing this emergence of a whole community of black bloggers. Casey, is that having an effect on dialogue?
I suppose so. I mean, I got into blogging just because it's an outlet for me. Because if you are a blogger, you're someone who you think you have something a little different than what other people are saying, or even if you're saying the same thing, that you can say it better than others. So so I guess now that we can add our voices to this dialogue, because it is good that it's no longer like the top three networks that are presenting views, that people have so many more options out there than before. So, yeah.
Yabachi, do you think you're making a difference?
We're definitely making a difference. We can see it in a lot of the campaigns that we've engaged in over the last year, whether it be Sha'Carna Cotton or the Gen 6, and just raising awareness of the general populace. A lot of us have an enormous amount of daily hits. We've also coalesced together in some different groups, some such as the Afrosphere, and we have really been working together to put a lot of issues on the map, and being able to have that network with one another, where a great many of us will be able to put out the same information at the same time, have our own different perspectives, but things that are often not even covered by the mainstream media or are barely given mention, we are able to put out there and be another source of news for people to go to, another source of opinion beyond the norm. And I think that is very powerful for not only for us personally, but for the people, that they can have media that's outside of just the corporate media's hands.
This is something that's close to my heart. Last week, the 25th anniversary edition of Michael Jackson's Thriller was released.
In order to be able to discover.
It has sold over 100 million copies worldwide, and that's Michael in his prime before he got a little more blanco. So, Yabachi, where were you when you first heard this? I don't know how old you are, but
I was
you don't
four
have to tell
going
us.
On five when that came out.
Stab me in my old heart.
But, okay, I don't remember when the album exactly came out, like the day it dropped, but what I do remember is when the Thriller video, actually it was the Beat It video, appeared on MTV, and that was a big event for some reason. And back then there was actually weren't a lot of black artists on MTV. It was just Prince.
Michael Jackson's label had to basically go to the mat with MTV to even get the videos on.
Right. And I was in Detroit for some reason at some relative's house, and it was a big event to sit down in front of the TV, the whole family, and we pre-planned to sit down and watch that video that night. And we ended up getting the album for Christmas later on that year. My mom bought the 12-inch, and me and my sister basically scratched it up to death on our plastic Fisher-Price record player, if you remember those with the orange handle back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's still on the TV stand at my parents' house right now, but it's probably scratched up to death. I was kicking it and running over it.
Valencio, what did this album do for you?
I was in the eighth grade, I think, when it dropped. So I'm a little older than Yabachi, but I just remember loving it. I think that comes to mind was when he performed at the 25th anniversary of Motown, I think it was. And yes. A bunch of my friends came over to my house, and we were screaming in front of the television because he was doing the moonwalk. And it seemed like the whole world just stopped to watch that one performance. So it was definitely life-changing. And I think I had a cassette tape as well as the actual album.
Yeah, I was mainly a cassette girl myself. So, Casey, has all the drama that Michael Jackson has been through and generated, has that, you know, faded the shine a little bit on what he did in the past, or are those two separate things?
Well, you know, I was actually a member of the Jacksons fan club back in the 1970s. I still have a signed photo of the entire Jackson family that I might put on eBay one day. Yeah.
Did you have the red jacket with the zippers on it?
No, I didn't go that crazy. You know, but actually, I've got to admit, I'm more of a Prince fan. So I'm looking forward to the 25th anniversary of Purple Rain. That's what I'm really looking forward to. And I'll probably put something. I've actually written on my blog about the whole Michael Jackson versus Prince. Michael Jackson, definitely a lot of the shine is gone. I mean, I just wish the guy would just go back in the studio and just make good music like he used to. But, you know, the kind of thing that Prince still does.
Keep children out of his bed.
Well, yeah, that kind of thing, too.
I didn't
say parents
it.
Keep your kids away from him would be the
please
best thing. So,
well, I To take us out, I want to play a little bit of the new Michael Jackson, that part of a whole cover of the original tracks. This is The Girl Is Mine with will.i.am.
The way I rock, the way I rock.
I don't understand the way you think, saying that she's yours like mine. Sitting roses and your silly dreams, it's really just a waste of time, because she's mine.
She's mine.
Valencia, how are we feeling about that?
Oh, don't mess with a classic.
And on that note, I'm going to bid all of you guys farewell. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Valencia Rohner blogs at Diary of a Content Black Woman. She was here with me at our NPR West studios. Casey Lahr Tigg's blog is called The Casey Lahr Tigg Show. He was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And writer and social activist Yabachi Boswell writes the blog Black Perspective. He was at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee.